All right, welcome everybody. Welcome to this episode of Roll Around the Barrel, the Vintage Baseball Podcast, talking to vintage baseball players, coast to coast, border to border. It's almost like that's a catchphrase now. I should just keep saying it. Wow, big thrill today. It's a big catch in the big ocean of vintage baseball. This is one of the Moby Dicks of the world. According to everybody else, you know what? I don't even know him. I'm going to get to know him right now for the first time. From the Eastwood Iron Horses of Dayton, Ohio, it is Earl Fireman McDaniel. Earl, how you doing?
Great. Beautiful day in Dayton, Ohio, except for the rain and lack of baseball.
Yeah, so that doesn't sound like a beautiful day.
I'm trying to put some positive spin on a bad situation.
Hey, do you go out and do your biking in the rain?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
How hard does it have to be raining for you to say, nope, I'll pass?
It's not how hard it rains. There's a degree of temperature range from just above freezing to probably around 50 degrees with rain, where it's a hypothermia area that I try to avoid.
So basically you're hardcore.
It's not as much fun as it sounds.
You're hardcore, and you're going to go out and do it, except in extremities.
Yeah, I'm out there pretty much every day.
One of the interesting things about you that we're going to get into at the end of the episode, but I want to tease everybody about right now that is listening to this episode, is that you're a military physicist. Is this true?
Yeah, I'm a military contractor with a physics degree.
So you're just about the smartest person I'll probably ever talk to. Is this true?
I doubt it. It means I have a physics degree. It doesn't mean I'm smart.
No, actually, it does. It does mean that you're smart. So we're going to get into an area at the end that I'm just going to sit back and let you go on, because I will have nothing to add. But definitely, I do have pulled up in front of me some physics questions. So we'll see how smart you are when it comes to the physics, I guess.
Yeah, I'll have to channel my inner Sheldon or something.
But we're going to go through baseball first. If you listen to any of the episodes, I usually start off with, and I'm going to today, with your entire gamut of baseball, from your earliest memories of playing and being a fan as a child all the way up to where we are today with you on the Eastwood Iron Horses, if you wouldn't mind.
Okay. Got interested in baseball early with the Big Red Machine. Grew up outside of Cincinnati, Ohio, and when people asked, do you play ball? They didn't mean football or basketball. They didn't have to put the pre-label on it. It was baseball. And I remember my dad taking me to see a couple Reds games and trying to yell for Mr. Bench to turn around and wave at us, you know, up in the red upper deck where he can't even hear that far. But I still have some memories of, I remember a Pirates game and a Giants game. Went to see, and got to start playing when I was 12. No, 9. 9 to 12 years old out in 7 Mile, Ohio. And actually, I think it was in my third game, I got hit by an inside pitch on the finger, and it ripped off 2 of my fingernails. They're on the field. And still love the game enough that I was back 2 days later with a plastic cap over the damaged fingers, with the coach saying, I don't think I can let your son play, to my dad. And my dad was watching me throw out in the outfield. He said, okay, you get to go tell him he doesn't get to play.
Oh.
And the coach didn't have a heart to do that, so I played.
How well did you play?
How well did I play?
with the plastic cap over your fingers.
Well, as a 9-year-old, batting against 12-year-olds, I wasn't expected to do a whole lot anyway.
All right.
I don't remember getting a hit that first year at all. I remember my first hit coming as a 10-year-old. I remember hitting a line drive over the second baseman about the second or third game in. But being from a small town, to make enough teams, you had to put large age groups together to form teams, and that's just the way it was.
So that's 9 years old. Did you keep playing Little League all the way through?
Yeah, I played Little League until, 15 was the end of our league, but we had a team that got the team, quote-unquote, bunch of guys that got together and played ball until we graduated high school. I played for Edgewood High School in Trenton, Ohio.
And so your fandom actually is back when the Cincinnati Reds are a big deal. And
oh, yeah. I remembered sleeping with the transistor radio underneath the pillow, just high enough that I could hear Marty and Joe broadcasting games in my ear, but my dad couldn't hear out in the living room that I wasn't asleep. But yeah, big baseball fan.
And so tell me about how when the Reds won the World Series, what year was that in the 80s? Was that in the late 80s, the Reds?
It was 75, 76.
Didn't they win after that? It was 75, 76. Yeah, go ahead and go and start back with that one. Go ahead.
Yeah, 75, 76. I remember it was just like 1980 later. It was a big deal. Got to stay up past my bedtime to watch World Series games. But I remember watching them play the Red Sox and the Yankees in the back-to-back series. And I recall Johnny Bench hitting the home run in Yankee Stadium. I remember the long game with Fisk getting the long one up the line there in Fenway. Just great baseball moments. I mean, you want your home team to win, but just was addicted to the sport itself. And at the same time, I'm starting to take an interest in science, and I'm reading a lot of information about astronomy, nearly astronauts. And I was reading that they were all fans of the Colt 45s that became the Houston Astros, and I started playing the Astros, even though they were not a very good baseball team in that era. But I've been a fan of them ever since.
What did it have anything to do with that incredibly terrible dome stadium that they played in at the time, the Astrodome, that at the time was like...
I wanted to see a game in the Astrodome, and it just never happened. But, yeah, I remember reading stories about when they opened early on with the ceiling was glass and the infielders were blinded by pop-ups, but they had to have something to get out of the heat and the mosquitoes that were down there because they said the old Colt 45 stadium, the players got eaten alive.
So do you play any baseball in high school?
Yeah, I played center field for Edgewood outside Trenton, Ohio.
All 4 years?
Played 3 years, had a disagreement with the coach, ran track my senior year.
Ouch. So did can I ask you what that disagreement was?
I'll tell you privately later. It's probably not something you want to put on the airwaves.
Oh, absolutely, then. Thanks for the
There's
heads up on that.
There's a little bit of intrigue there, and yeah. It gets into an area you probably don't want to get into. Oh. And it's not about me personally, but it's about my reaction to what was going on.
So did that take the taste of baseball out of your out of your mouth for a while? Were you down on baseball after high school?
It was a bit bitter, and I think it affected my brother too because he was an incoming freshman and tried out for the team and was cut since I didn't come back. I think there was a connection there, and I felt bad about that. And when I got into college, I preferred track to baseball. Still played a lot. I had a group of friends that we got together all the time and practiced softball. Played scrimmages against each other. Had a team in the recreational league there on campus that played in the spring. So still had a love for the game, but was kind of had lost some love for some of the organizational part of it.
So how many years are there between the last time you played organized baseball and then falling into vintage baseball?
Decades, and it's a bummer. I never heard of vintage baseball outside of the strike in the late 80s, early 90s. Major League Baseball went on strike, and my mom sent me articles about the Red Stockings and the Buckeyes flying down at Sherwin Woods. But I had to work, wasn't able to get down to see them. I knew they existed, but didn't catch a game until 6 years ago with my youngest son was up in Michigan at a baseball tournament, had an off day. We went to the Henry Ford and watched the Lottie Dawes and just fell in love with the game from batting practice. Had players coming over asking us if we really wanted to be as close to the sidelines as we were. And we started asking more questions about the bats and the rules and the uniforms and how the rules changed from one game period to another. Talked to a couple of the players afterwards, including one of the third basemen from the Lottie Dolls and Henry Ford house itself. And he was encouraging us, saying, look, you guys can do this. If you got a love for the game, you're from Dayton, go talk to the Clodbusters. He knew the teams in the areas. See what they think. Maybe you can form your own team. Came back, started watching some of the Clodbusters games. Found out I had a couple other friends that were also interested in vintage. Bob Bear, in particular, got pulled in to play for the Generals in a game here in Carillon Park, and he posted pictures on Facebook. I'm like, oh, holy cow, he knows somebody that can actually get me in this stuff. So when the Generals were short going into the Tip Cup, they invited Bob, myself, and another future Iron Horse, Dan Sparky Carey, to play in the games. And we went out and got shellacked by the Columbus Capitals 16-0, but just absolutely loved it. Uh-huh. The attitude and behavior of the Capitals, it didn't feel like the score mattered. You were playing because you loved the game. And I know Dan and I looked at each other after the game and like, wow, that's what we've been missing. We've been playing softball together for decades, but there was something missing. And it came out in the vintage game in a way that you just don't get on a softball field.
So you've only been playing for 5 years. Is that,
yep,
you started Eastwood 5 years ago, and that's it? That's all you've had vintage baseball wise?
Yeah.
And
other than that term in the Tip Cup. Yeah.
So, I wasn't aware that Eastwood's only been around for 5 years. How did you get the nickname Fireman?
Unlike a lot of other vintage teams where you get a nickname assigned to you when you do something, we started the Iron Horses with the idea of not only were we going to play, but we wanted to do community service work, especially the kids and youth organizations, little leagues. So all of us originally picked nicknames that trace back to railroad history. So that when you ask the kid, you know, what do you like about baseball? They could ask you, what do you like about working on the railroad? You could directly relate your name to some kind of made up story about what you did working on your job. So reading through the descriptions of the early railroad jobs, I came across the fireman was the guy that stayed up all night getting the train ready to go, did the greasing, did the prepping for the wood, make sure there was enough water for the boiler, and was the last one to go home, making sure all the maintenance was done after a trip. I thought, boy, that sounds a lot like a coach. I mean, it's the lowest position as far as getting the train to run, but it fits a lot of what I think I have to do, even as a Christian, and setting grounds and barriers and a place for my team to come play, kind of like washing feet. I have to be able to willing to do the lowly stuff if I want people to come and enjoy what's going to happen. So it's not about, you know, putting a fire out. It's about setting a place where a fire can go.
How many times do you get asked where you fight fires at?
All the time. It would help if we'd have a set roster would show up all the time, but every weekend's a little bit different depending on who's injured, who's working, who's got a job, whose kid's sick, who's... I don't even think of myself as having a firm position. I just go wherever I think I need to go.
Well, those are the trials and tribulations of having a vintage baseball club.
Yes, sir. Welcome to the club.
It is not as glamorous as a position as you would think. Quite the opposite.
No, but it's worth it.
Well, yeah, the highs are really high and the lows are really low. I wish I stayed in the middle a little bit more. Hey, tell me some of your favorite places that you've had a chance to play.
Yeah, I remember that question on your sheet and about 14 places popped into my head. Field of Dreams was obviously a big deal because of the movie set. But I think one of the things that really attracts me to vintage is every place you go is different. So there's the apple tree in Muffin Meadow, and Eastwood, we've got a left field line. It's a sycamore tree that we call Plinko, like the Japanese pinball game, and it sorts whether or not the ball is fair or foul. I like going down to Sharon Woods. with the historic center they've got down there. I like going down to Lexington, Kentucky, where the Barons play, and they've got short field and right with a different post. And if it goes over or under the post, get different bases depending on what happened. You know, you get a lot of feeling like you're 10 years old again, and you're making up rules that say, okay, you can't hit it into the flower garden because mom will get mad. But I kind of like that feeling about vintage. And I like exploring that in each little place I go, whether or not Canal Fulton has an open ground area with trees in it, to Tip Cup has got places on along the edge of the parking lot on the outfield on the right side that get in the way of high fly balls that people hit them. So I like the fact that each place is a little bit different. And I really couldn't figure out one or two places that I like better. Kind of like them all.
Have you played one of the places that always gets brought up when I ask this question? Probably the most liked field, if you went by the numbers on my interviews, is a Spiegel Grove. Have you ever played there?
No, but I've heard about it.
Yeah, I also
that would be awesome.
So, well, you got a lot of career left. How old are you right now, Earl?
53.
Yeah, so you're in the same boat as me. I'm 48, and I did not come into vintage baseball until 10 years ago. And it bothers me that I did not find this so much earlier. Boy, if I just would have found this in my 20s, I'd be such a happier person, I feel like, in my baseball mind.
I had the same conversation with Speedy Overmeyer down with the Red Stockings. That if I followed through when my mom first started sending me articles during that baseball strike, I could have had two more decades of vintage baseball. I mean, I'm grateful for what I got, but boy, 20 extra years would have been a lot more fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know how it would have went for me around here, because the Bay City Independents, the team I started with 10 years ago, if I would have found them earlier than that, they were stacked and full, and I probably wouldn't have got on the club anyway. So I don't know. I probably wouldn't have ended up playing anyway. So, I at least would have been able to watch it and bide my time to be able to get on, because we don't have up here around the Saginaw Bay City area, we have, I don't know, like three or four clubs to choose from in any vicinity of driving. So, because most of the clubs in Michigan are all southern Detroit area. And so it's not like I had my pick.
Right.
But yeah, you named a lot of places, favorite places to play. Can you tell me some of your favorite, and as many as you want to talk about, your favorite vintage events that happened that you've participated in?
More floods of memory. First thought would be the Roundhouse Rodeo event we had at Eastwood a couple years ago. One of your teams from Michigan came down to Taylor Wolverine, speaking to Jeff Hicks. And I was out in the outfield, I think it was actually during the game against Taylor, and I had a chance to look around, and there were cars parked on the road, and bikes jumped off the bike path. We had two games going on at once, and people were just stopping whatever they were doing to watch vintage baseball in the park. And it hit me how special it was, really, that we had brought that kind of festival to Dayton, and that people were enjoying it. I had dozens of people ask me during that day, what kind of league is this? How often are you going to be back at Eastwood? Well, how can we get involved? So that was definitely a high point. Other festivals, definitely the Ohio Cup, going there and sharing love with vintage baseball from people from several different states, and starting with the Friday night game where everything's more relaxed, to the Tiffin Festival up the Tiffin Seneca area in Tiffin, Ohio. And they had a really nice tournament layout down there in Lexington a couple of years ago, where when we showed up, the Monarchs and the Barons had already started the first game of the event, and there was no room in the parking lot for my team to get in. With the Barons being the only team in Kentucky, they drew several hundred people from miles around, including senior citizen centers with buses and kids with their dads that had driven. I talked to one family, they drove 200 miles to watch vintage baseball because they didn't have it where the young man was from. Definitely the Heart of Vintage Baseball Tournament. The Black Bottom Nine put on a great event down here where they invite all of Southwest Ohio. It feels like a family reunion where you all get together and play. And I'm still trying to learn from them about tips on how to make a good meal for everybody. That's something that Eastwood really struggles with.
Oh, the after-match picnic.
Yeah, the after-match. We got guys that come up with great ideas, but we're not really good at putting in place. And boy, the Black Bottom Nine are really smooth about how they get everything out in a timely manner, and they set their schedule around when they're going to play and when we're going to eat. And still have a lot to learn from the Manning brothers about that.
Hey, how does that that Caesars Creek Pioneer Village Vintage Baseball Festival go? How well is that done?
That's done better than I thought it would, but it's a great opportunity for us. And I spoke about getting giving back to the community with the youth, but there's other things that we do, like help raise money for veterans. We do a thing at the Dayton VA every year with elected officials. The Caesars Creek's a nonprofit organization in the middle of a state park, and they're always hurting for funds to restore and maintain buildings that trace back to the time of the vintage baseball that we're playing. The site was originally used by one of the buildings there, has never been moved, but all these others have been brought in around a circle in the middle of a field from local areas. I think some of them were brought 30, 40 miles away. So it's a great opportunity to go play vintage baseball in a place that feels like you fit. I know the first time we did a trial run out there, I was subbing in for the Black Stockings out of Santaville against the Muffins before the Iron Horses played. And a guy came out of the woods with a flintlock over his shoulder dressed in bearskin. And I just started giggling, like, wow, this is such a great experience. But it's really grown, I think, into a great festival experience for people to see baseball. If you come into the park, see the buildings, you see baseball getting played. If you're a ballist, you get to go visit all the buildings and learn more about the history from that time period beyond just playing the game. I think that's a great way to get people together and share the love of the game and help out another group. So hopefully we get to do our fall event this year with spring getting canceled due to COVID.
Spring canceled, summer in trouble. I think everybody at this point is holding out hope for fall. I think that's the most realistic, most hopeful time frame is the fall, unfortunately, to say that out loud, it hurts.
No vaccine and testing. I mean, we can get into that too, but
I don't want to.
That's what you want.
I don't want to. There's too much of it as it is. I want to get away from it. And I'm going to get away from it right now because I'm going to ask you about one of your favorite off the field memories. This is good content that's going to make everybody feel good. You went and saw your first vintage game at Greenfield Village with your son, Ryan. Talk to me about that experience.
Yeah, I think I touched on that a little bit earlier. But Ryan and I were looking for something to do to get away from baseball. We wound up going to watch a baseball game. Went to the Henry Ford. We knew about the old buildings and the museum itself, the Ford complex. But when we saw there was going to be vintage baseball play, we kind of dropped our plans for the rest of the day and just went down and sat and watched that game. And you talk about being dipped in magic waters. We sat down on the first baseline. I think we were only 10 feet away from the first baseman, and the guy came over and said, you're allowed to sit here, but you may wind up participating. And he was kind of warning us that throws may go over. Right. Ryan and I said, you got uniforms? And they laughed and said, no, we can't do that. We don't know who you are. But like, oh, okay, honest, we're good guys. Give us uniforms.
So did I hear you right when you said you went to Greenfield Village, but you didn't anticipate spending the entire day or a majority of the day watching a baseball game? You just saw it one was
being... No, we were looking for something to... Yeah, we were just looking for something to do, and we told the rest of his baseball team. We were up there in the belly of the beast, up there around Michigan. I can't say that real well as an Ohio fan. I get a little bit... something stuck in my throat.
Listen, you'll say it
And I'll like it. Is that what I heard?
No, no, you don't have to like it, but you have to say it.
No. Oh, I have to say it. Actually, I had a really good time bike riding up around there, too. It's good biking territory. But we told the rest of the team, hey, we're going to the Dearborn area, and we're going to see the Henry Ford. Anybody else want to go? And nobody came with us. And then when they found out we saw this baseball game, everybody was really pumped that they hadn't gone and checked it out with us. We were telling them, oh, no, they don't use gloves. And it kept going back to, oh, you mean the little gloves? No, no gloves at all. I had to pull out pictures from my camera and prove to them, like, no, Sears is a second baseman. He's covering the guy off the bag, and he doesn't have a glove on.
So,
just watching the game and hearing the umpires walk around with the megaphones, explaining things, asking questions, and seeing balls hit into right field, and people that are watching the game on the hill underneath the train, scrambling for cover as an outfielder coming. It just felt like you were part of something instead of being detached on the other side of a chain link fence. And I understand the safety rules that you need in place for softball and baseball, but just to feel like you're part of a game, even though you're not actively playing, it's such a big draw with Finnish baseball. And I think it helps spread that love of the game back.
Do you remember who the Laddies were playing in that match you saw?
Yeah, the Blues.
Indianapolis or Cleveland?
No, the blue shirts. Was it Parma?
Oh, the Nationals. The other in-house club. Okay.
Yeah, the other in-house club.
So that must have been like their last. I think they do that last game of the season. I'm not sure how that works out. They fill in when there's a cancellation, maybe. I don't know. I don't know how it works. I'm not going to say any more about it. Forget I said anything. Hey.
Okay. I'm going to say it was in July of, like, 2015, somewhere in there. It was like a July 4th weekend.
Oh, you know what? Maybe they do that 4th of July. I don't know. I'm going
to
look into it.
It was really odd that we got invited to a 4th of July baseball tournament, and then we played 2 days before July 4th and the day after, but not the day of. So we had games Thursday, Friday, Sunday, but nothing on Saturday. And it worked out great to go see the vintage game, but it was really weird as far as our own schedule was concerned.
So while we're on a subject that involves your son, I did ask you who your favorite vintage baseball player is, and you gave me the very politically correct fatherly answer about how it's your son. And so what we're going to do is I want you to tell me why your son is your favorite vintage baseball player. And then we're going to talk about some of your other vintage baseball players. And this is, when I ask for your favorite vintage baseball players, I mean like on the field, like watching them, like players that obviously in the vintage community, you like so many players personality-wise and get along with so many people and you're around so many people. That list is endless. I'm looking for the guys that when they're out there playing, you are watching them. You don't miss their at-bats. You don't miss them in the field when you can watch. But start with your son and tell me about your son as a vintage baseball player.
My son has a natural enthusiasm for life, I think. And it really comes out in baseball. It's been there since his first word was ball, and he didn't learn another word for probably 4 months because he didn't need another word. That was the only thing he cared about. And I was working with my oldest son on hitting on a tee, Tim. He's about 5. Ryan could barely pick up a bat when he was 2. So I thought if I'm going to have them both around the tee at the same time, I made Tim a right-handed hitter and Ryan a left-handed hitter. And he would walk around the yard with his wiffle ball bat hitting bugs out of the air. Just love the game. Look forward to him playing T-ball and having him on the field. And he still has that love and that enthusiasm for the game. And it carries over for not just me, but I think the rest of our team on the Iron Horses when he's there. Plus, he's got a really dry sense of humor, and he'll say something. I can't even think of an example now, but you're like, what? And then you start laughing like 30 seconds later, like, did he really just say that? So it's just a great combination to have out on the field. Whether I haven't played against him, but I would think it wouldn't matter what side you're on. If you hear Ryan, you know he loves the game, and he loves to be there. So, and then getting into your other question about players I would love to see, I'm trying to remember his name. I'm actually Facebook friends with him. The guy that caught for the Taylor Wolverines.
Oh, you know what? I don't remember who the catcher was. I did not see.
Bigger guy, really fast on his feet.
They're all bigger and guys on Taylor.
Yeah, there were a lot of bigger guys on Taylor.
Was it Diesel? Did Diesel play catcher? Yeah. Chuck Sherrill? I don't know what position Chuck played.
Chuck played on the team, and he was fun to watch hit. But this guy could hit, and boy, he was really fast on his feet. And I remember foul tipping one. Even halfway through my swing, I'm like, I'm out. And I know I'm going to hit it up near. He's going to run 30 feet, make an over-the-shoulder catch going backwards, and he did. Boy, it was just fun to watch, even though it was discouraging. Watching Chuck Sherrill hit, that was something else. And Jeff, too. Chris Yee was on that team. Boy, he could hit and run. That was a lot of fun to watch. There's a guy down on the Barons named Yankee with a big stick. And then Thomas Klaus, boy, he hit some sky balls last year over the trees over there in right field. Then you get on the Capitals watching Ian hit and their catcher. Yeah, I believe he's an ex-hockey goalie. Is that right?
Nick Sanders.
Yeah, I think it is Nick Sanders.
I don't know
boy,
about
he covers a lot of ground.
I don't know about the hockey. I do know that he does curling, and I actually interviewed him. He's one of my very first interviews of this, my first season, and so we didn't talk about hockey. We talked a lot about the curling, though, how he travels around with his wife and does that. So I guess there's a natural progression from hockey to curling.
Could be. I just remember he covers a lot of ground. I mean, and he's fun to watch. He's just so quick on his feet. And ditto for the center fielder, whose name I never knew. But going back to the first game I played up there in the Tip Cup, I remember watching him, and he dove to his left and one hand caught a ball in the air. That game, and then two games later, I'm watching the Capitals play the Black Bottom Nine, and he dove to his right and caught a ball one-handed. I thought, holy crap. You know, that's hard enough to do with a glove, let alone just skin on your hand going both different directions.
Yeah, that might be the honey badger you're talking about. And
I think that is right. That name rings a bell.
So
yeah.
When he's in the outfield, your best strategy is to hit it right at him because he has a lot higher possibility of dropping the ones hit right at him than he does anywhere else. Once he stops thinking about and just reacts, he's making incredible plays. He's getting to everything. It's a waste. But if you can hit a high lofting fly ball right at him that he has to camp underneath and think about, sometimes I think all of us have issues with those ones. I hate standing there waiting for a ball to come down. That's way too many thoughts that enter my head.
Yeah, too long to think. I think the cleanest person I've seen on those is probably Dennis Bennett with Akron. He just seems to be really focused and able to maintain that no matter how long he has to wait for the ball to come down.
Hey, what are some of your favorite clubs to play against that you've had a chance to?
Boy, I wish I could see that team we met in Kansas again.
Was that the Topeka, the Western Baseball Club of Topeka, I believe?
It was, from Cowtown. There were actually two of them that came to the Field of Dreams with us.
Oh,
Cowtown. We did a lot of, Cowtown, and there were two of them. But they were both from that same facility. I had a great time at the Field of Dreams with them. We'd done a lot of research online about this is our one shot. Who do we want to meet? And we got done with that game, looked at each other, and like, wow, this was a really great matchup. And unfortunately, we're still probably 12 hours away from each other by car.
Yeah, that's tough. That's why you count on all these big events as an excuse to run into these clubs that you're just not going to be able to just schedule a match with. That's unrealistic, but going to these events that you can possibly see two or three of those teams you'll never get to see, that's what makes those worth it.
Oh, yeah. And then, I know I wrote on your sheet, we the Iron Horses, I think, and I'll try to speak for the team. I kind of want to say we like meeting everybody. And what really kind of sucks about this COVID thing is we've got teams that we've scheduled in May that we'll never see again the rest of the year, and there's no way to make it up, including the guys across the street here with the Clodbusters. We're supposed to see them in 3 weeks, so we'll see it in 3 or 4 weeks over in Columbus at German Village, so we'll see how that works out. But I like to be able to rotate around, and it's like a family reunion every time I see the Black Bottom Nine or the Canal Jumpers or the Indianapolis Blues or the Muffins or even the Mules, as much as we get on at each other about working on the railroad versus working on the canals. And
oh, yeah.
Historically,
yeah.
Those groups did not get along. And I really appreciate when they came to Eastwood, they're handing out their flyers on the evils of the railroad. I mean, that kind of stuff you just don't get in softball. And it's all good natured, even though it is somewhat, you know, a little bit in your face. But that's all part of it. It's good stuff.
Yeah, that's one of the highlights when the Mules show up to Greenfield Village and would play at the Worlds, is that train goes through the outfield and they're yelling at the train, you know, damn the Iron Beast and all this stuff, and they're handing out their flyers. It absolutely adds to the event, and in my limited knowledge of them on a personal level, they seem like great guys. I always am looking for a way to get them involved in anything I do, or just want to get involved in something they do. Like, I always hear
the best. Yeah, we've only
gotten
along well with BT, Phillips, and the rest of the team. When we played at their place, they stopped the game in about the fourth inning. There was a canal boat going by, and the umpire was, you know, talking highly about how beautiful and how majestic and how quiet and serene the canal boat was going by. And then he turned around and he started pointing, unlike these dirty railroaders burning our woods. And I mean, wow. Talk about a great game break.
Hey, you know,
we kind of knew it was coming though. I went to the Casey Jones house in Tennessee on vacation with my wife right before then. And I got a iHeart Trains pin for them that I gave to for their bag that they carry around to carry afterwards, and presented that to them afterwards, the game, as a thank you for playing. So that was fun countering with their attack on us.
So let's start transitioning into some other things. I want to get to the questions and comments that I've gotten once I put that I was interviewing you. This is by far the most commented on interview I'm about to do that I've had so far. And first I want to say that Landon Smith is a huge fan of yours. He also requested to me for you to be interviewed. He says so many great things. You are one of his favorite people alive. And that's not a joke. He just says all these great things about you. And
did he tell you how we met?
I don't.
This is another good vintage story.
Yeah, go ahead. Tell that story.
So the Iron Horses were getting a team together. We only had, no kidding, 4 shirts available at the time when the Buckeyes and Red Stockings had their Super Bowl game down at Sharon Woods. So Bill Pitt, Dietman invited me down just to get to know some other people. And I got to talk with them during the day about insurance and some other stuff. Gave me a lot of useful information. But Yeti was the first person I met. He showed up after I did, and I'm trying to find the field. He showed me the field. And when I came up to hit, I'm looking, there's 16 people on defense. I'm all nervous, representing a new team. Everybody wants to know who I am. I said, just hit the ball hard. I get a nice, solid line drive over shortstop. I come around first, and Yeti's playing first. Went to shake my hand, and with one arm up off the ground so that my cleats were 9 inches in the air, and he was asking for the pitcher to throw him the ball for a pickoff. So it was a welcome to vintage, and by the way, you sure are a little guy kind of moment, all in the same thing. But I love telling that story, and it just, to me, it shows how playful and friendly and welcoming Yeti is, all in one breath. But I think highly of him, too.
His first comment, and I know that you saw it, but it says something to the effect of P equals MV.
Squared. Yeah.
What is that in a
It's a formula
reference
for
to?
kinetic energy.
So that's what
So, yeah,
happened when you came around first base, basically, right?
well, he took my kinetic energy away. Yeah. That was more like F equals MA, and I ran into the force that is the Yeti.
Dennis Wagman from the Black Flags of Droverton wants me to ask you about your game day socks.
Right. Socks. I have a whole bag full of different sock colors. Something I started early on. I really appreciate the way the vintage community welcomes each other and treats the game respectfully rather than some of what I run into at softball where you got to worry about somebody work, keying your car or meeting you in the parking lot later.
Oh.
And out of respect for the other teams, I try to match my socks to the other team's colors. So if I'm going to play Canal Jumpers out of Tip City, I'll wear like black and red, which is the color of their logo. Or when I played the Whiskey Island Shamrocks at the Tiffin Seneca Heritage Cup, I had a sock on that had clovers on it to match their uniform. Doesn't mean I'm going to play less hard. Doesn't mean I don't want to do well, but it does mean that I respect the people I'm playing against. And I realize that we don't have different teams. We don't have games. So it's important to share that love with the other people in the Finnish baseball community.
That's really cool that you do that. The next question comes from Jeff Cantrell of the Buckeyes. He wants to know what the hardest part about riding your bike across America is.
I saw that question right before you called. The book's coming out online in chapters, so there's some things to look forward to. The hardest thing for me to get over was the saddle sores I got in Nevada. The one sore in particular swelled up right in the area I was sitting on. It was very uncomfortable. And the only way to get across the country was to ice the region multiple times a day before and after I rode. So if you think about how many nerve endings are in that part of your body and putting ice in the area, that'll kind of give you an idea of how I wasn't real thrilled about the idea of doing that, the icing that is, but it was necessary.
You mentioned you.
The
Oh, go ahead.
loss of the van was definitely a big blow. I never would have thought the support vehicle would be trashed across the United States. And the worst part of that was the feeling my dad got. He was kind of blaming himself, and it was he didn't chase a deer. He didn't intentionally try to wreck the van. He got the speed down as much as he could, but it still totaled the vehicle, leaving us in quite a bind there around the Colorado-Kansas border. And another big blow was I was a Metroparks volunteer. We had a gentleman that we knew was having some issues after a major festival. We tried to locate him, and he went in the river and drowned. That one hurt. Never want to have that happen,
Yeah.
especially in an event just designed to be for fun. So those are probably the three biggest.
You talked about you have a book online that you're releasing chapters at a time. Did I hear that right? Where can
Yeah,
people
neverwriter.com.
never,
So
that's what I was just going to ask you. What was that website again?
Endeavor Rider, EndeavourRider.com. And it's the book I'm writing about the trip across the United States, all those incidences I talked about, plus others, and just the general everyday people I met. It was quite an experience seeing the country by bicycle and meeting people one on one.
As we scroll down here, I see that Chuck Sherrow actually asked about your tournament in Dayton. We covered that. He says it's the first time he stopped to salute a train. You did.
Yeah,
He asked if you enjoyed playing the Taylor Wolverines, and you did, from what I've
yes.
heard.
The score was lopsided, but so what?
And Rudy Frias is asking what your favorite Hubble telescope image is. Do you have
I
one?
think, yeah. I think it was an early image that they did of the Horsehead Nebula in Orion back when it first went up that really struck me. I'd seen the image. The Horsehead Nebula is pretty popular in astronomy photography, but that image without the atmosphere in a way really upped my enthusiasm and love for space and thinking of there's a lot more out there than just one little planet that we occupy. So that struck me. There's been other sense where you think about other galaxies and such, but just seeing that image with such clarity and it was like going from the second grade to maybe high school level artistry or something, if you want to compare it to that kind of thing.
While we're kind of on the subject, let me ask your opinion. In your opinion, on a scale of percentage, how likely is the theory of the Big Bang to reality?
I think there was a Big Bang. It is part of reality.
But is that I guess what my question is the Big Bang more of a theory or more of a reality? Like, do you understand what I'm saying?
I think so. There's different steps and progressions in science from idea to law. And to make something a law, you've got to have a lot of information to confirm something. So to say something is a theory isn't quite a law, but that doesn't mean that it's not valid. Like, gravity is still a theory. Why is it still a theory? Well, we haven't determined how particles interact to create gravity. But as you noticed with the high fly ball coming ahead, I mean, the balls still come down, and they come down where we expect them to, and we can predict it. So theories are pretty strong indicators that we figured something out. So, yeah, I'd go with the fact there was a Big Bang. Now, if you want to get into the theology about who created the Big Bang, that gets into other topics. But, yeah, I think there was one.
So that brings us to what you do for a living and what a lot of people are listening to this episode about. So I'm going to give it ample time to marinate, and I am going to ask the dumbest questions. I just feel like I can't win with this. But tell everybody your position, where you do it, and what an average day of work is for somebody in your field. What are you trying to accomplish on a day's work?
Boy, are you going to be disappointed. Hi, I'm a physicist by degree. I work for Leidos Engineering at the Air Force Research Laboratory at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. Most of my work focuses around transitioning of sensors from people that have developed ideas to putting them in what are called the special programs offices, the SPOs at the bottom of the hill here at Wright-Patt, where weapon systems are enabled. So before a weapon system comes online, you have to do a lot of testing to make sure it does what it's supposed to do, that we can identify our people from the others and the others' people from civilians. And to make all that happen, somebody has to fill out a lot of paperwork. The joke is the airplane can't take off if the weight of the paperwork exceeds the weight of the airplane itself. And I'm the lucky person that gets to do a lot of that paperwork.
Ouch.
Yeah, it pays well, though. to be more specific, there's a lot of different sensors that have to be tested, and I have to make sure the airspace, the range, the military vehicles, the FAA permissions, security aspects are all lined up so that we can do tests. And when things started closing down due to COVID, I was actually out of war games in Arizona doing evaluations on large scale, which was both a good and a bad thing, because the corner of Arizona I was in was fairly secluded, but the bad thing was I had to get home, and I didn't know what kind of gauntlet I was going to have to run on the way back.
Sure. Sure. So now I'm going to ask some questions, the questions people really want me to ask you.
Okay.
So do your best. how long can you use
it? Oh, look. call's breaking up. Oh, what?
How long can you use a cell phone before you get a brain tumor?
I sound like a biophysicist. Depends on the cell phone and how far away you have it from your head. Yes, talking on it more is not good. There are transmitters that are putting things into your skull that are not good. But if you have a Bluetooth emitter or Bluetooth connection, then you're taking your head further from the emitter, and that's probably a good thing. Older cell phones put out more power than the new ones do, I believe. So I don't think it's as bad as what it was in the 80s with the State Highway Patrol using radar that was really powerful next to their head. And a lot of those guys wound up getting cancer. But anyway, yeah, I think it can happen. And no, I'm not going to give a timeline.
If I'm on an elevator that breaks loose and plummets and plummets down the shaft, can I avoid getting hurt by jumping up in the air at the last second?
That's that old Bill Cosby skit that he didn't know if it was going to work, but he's going to give it a try. I like that idea. You got nothing else to lose if you're in the situation. No, it probably won't help, but if you have nothing else to do, give it a shot, right?
What did Schrodinger's cat experiment actually prove?
It wasn't so much an experiment as a thought process. And it proves it when you examine something, you change its nature. And that gets to be very important on the quantum level, not so much flight tests for the Air Force Research Laboratory. But when you have quantum that you can either know exactly where they're at or exactly where they're going, but you can't know both at the same time, the thought process was to prove it. You can't approach both sides of the equation in the same experiment. So if you want to find out both pieces of information, you got to come up with experiments that focus on the different aspects and try to combine the data.
How are you liking my physics questions?
So far, so good.
Here we go.
I still have an image of, you know, Bill Cosby's head up the top of the elevator, like you said. That's all right.
All right, here's the next question. Why is a 12-volt household battery harmless, but the shock from a 12-volt car battery will kill you?
Not the voltage that kills you, it's the current. And it actually depends on where it goes across. So having it, my dad was an electrician. I remember coming home one day from school and his Jeep was in the driveway, which is not a good thing. I mean, the Jeep was never there. Dad was at work. But he had an arc go into his hand, and he always made sure, if he could, to lean up against something that was metal further up the arm so that the shock would not go across his heart. And he had a burn mark from, I believe, his wrist to almost his elbow, where some high current had gone across. But while it hurt the arm, and it did recover, thankfully, it didn't go from his hand up through across his heart and then down out his feet. That's where the danger is really at. When you shock your heart or your brain, bad things happen. There's no backup systems for those.
I think I survived that segment.
it took me a second, really, what you said. Yeah, me too.
You survived it. And I don't think I came out feeling stupid. I actually understood what you were talking about. So kudos to my science teacher in high school.
Yeah, whoever it was.
hey, on the sheet that you filled out, I find a lot of guys that I interview are professional wrestling fans at some point in their life. You have a story, and you're not a wrestling fan, but you actually have a story about Andre the Giant. Could you tell that?
Yeah. I was actually flying out for a test. It wasn't long before he died, and I was in the St. Louis airport, and somebody pointed out, hey, that's Andre the Giant over there eating. Okay, yeah, whatever. My wife's a fan of the Princess Bride, but I wasn't a big fan into wrestling. And he had a couple of bodyguards there, and he was just having a meal, politely answering questions from people. I remember watching one guy walk up and get an autograph. And I turned back around and talking to a coworker, I believe it was Steve Summers I was traveling with at the time, and we hear some yelling. this gentleman came in and he was all wound up about something in wrestling that happened, and he's yelling at Andre. And he goes to attack him. And I remember a bodyguard picked the gentleman up and threw him up against the wall over a dinner table where a couple were eating, and stood over him with his arms crossed waiting for the guy to get back up. Airport police showed up. The gentleman showed the police his identification, the bodyguard. Paid the couple for the meal, put some extra money. I don't know how much, but I remember seeing him pull out a wallet and putting bills in the gentleman's hand. Airport police carted off the gentleman that had done the yelling. And before my flight left, Andre the Giant's flight took off. And everybody had seen this display of stupidity. And as Andre got up, the giantism had really wore down his body. He's walking with a cane that barely looked like it could support his weight. He's all hunched over. And it was just a tearful moment to watch this gentleman that had been such a star on TV with his athleticism being barely able to walk to his airplane after being challenged by a moron over something that didn't really matter. Kind of became a fan of the man after that. I was sad to hear of his passing. I'm not going to say I talked to him because I didn't, but I think that image is going to stick with me for the rest of my days.
Now, before we get to the final segment of the episode, which is giving you the old pepper, how much riding do you do on a daily basis, bicycle riding? How many miles are you going a day?
Oh, my first answer was going to be not enough. I average about 28 to 30 miles a day. Yesterday I did 53 in just under 3 hours. Sorry.
Something like that. So I have a bike that I ride around locally just for some exercise. Really, it's nothing special. But I have a really big butt, Earl, and I find that the bicycle seat, my butt kind of swallows it a little bit, and it's very uncomfortable. I don't think I've ever been on a bicycle seat that's comfortable. Do you have a recommendation for somebody in my situation?
Yes, go to a bike store and try a bunch of different seats. And that's that sounds like a cop-out, but it's actually kind of a stock answer among cyclists. Don't do what fits somebody else's butt or back or shoulders or neck or stomach as far as what you eat. I mean, take recommendations, but then go find things that work for you. So there are seats for larger guys, and I even remember a story. I didn't get the guy's name, but there was actually a professional football player that lives in the Springfield, Ohio area that got a larger size seat, and he actually got extensions on his pedals because his feet were a little bit wider. And I don't know who the guy was, but supposedly he loves riding. Now he's out fairly consistently because it's more comfortable for him. So one of the things that I'll get into in my book, going up back to Jeff's question with the saddle sores, I was trying to figure out how to fix that problem. And I had people trying to offer me new seats, and I didn't know whether or not that would fit my butt better or create knee problems or what was going to happen. So that was actually part of the challenge I had to get over. But usually a good bike stop will let you try different seats, and they won't try to force you into something. If you got somebody trying to force you onto one thing, go somewhere else.
Yeah, I'm not allowing anybody to force anything on me as far
on your butt.
On my butt. No forcing in the butt area.
No, that's not good.
Okay, now it's time. I don't know if you've listened to an episode that has this segment, but it's time to give you the old pepper. So these are 20 random questions, and I just want short answers. Your first thoughts. Okay. Some of these are physics questions, and you're going to really hate the fact that you have to give a quick short answer, but do your best. We'll circle back around if we have to.
Okay.
Here we go. What color is an atom?
None.
What are the specs of your bicycle?
Trek triple 1.2.
Is time travel possible?
I hope so.
What are your favorite snacks for a long bike ride?
Cliff Bar.
Who is your favorite Marvel Avenger?
Oh, just one?
Yes.
Iron Man.
Can light bend around corners?
Yeah.
What is the most overrated utensil?
Fork.
What is a good dried fruit?
Apple.
Lance Armstrong, is he an ass or was he just doing the same thing as everybody else?
Both.
if you were a Muppet, who would it be?
Oh, Beaker.
give me your Mount Rushmore of Cincinnati Reds players.
Johnny Bench, Zeta Pinson, Pete Rose, and King Griffey Jr.
Do atoms ever touch each other?
Yes.
What is your favorite candy bar?
Hershey's.
Can you name an overrated Major League Baseball player in any generation?
Yeah.
Who?
Oh, you want a name?
Yeah, give me an overrated player.
I would first guess Jose Canseco.
Why do the support vehicles in bicycle racing follow so close behind the riders?
So they can communicate with the rider.
A personal favorite question to all the Star Wars fans out there. How does a tractor beam work?
By pulling in math and using imagination that hasn't been invented yet.
How can a penny derail a train?
It doesn't.
What is your favorite 1980s action movie and why is it Die Hard?
Because Hans Zimmer. Hans Zimmer didn't do it. Hans is the bad guy. I mean, Alan Rickman is the man. What are you kidding me?
Absolutely. But he's no John McClane. Earlier you referred to Plinko as a Japanese pinball game, but everybody knows it's a game on The Price is Right. Why would you make such a silly analogy?
Where do you think The Price is Right got it from?
No, I refuse to think that.
My dad was in the Navy. He actually brought back a Plinko game. We had it in the basement. It was fun to play.
Ohio. It's round on the ends and high in the middle. Why?
Everything's got to be somewhere.
That brings that to an end. Round on the ends and high in the middle. You know what's funny is Ohio people really hate Michigan. And I don't feel that I have the same anger towards the state of Ohio. But is that because I'm a Spartan fan and not a Wolverine fan? Like, is it the Wolverines that really won't have anything to do with Ohio?
I've got a coworker of mine that graduated from Michigan State. And he always said that they took more angst with Michigan than they did Ohio. But on your question, I had a buddy of mine from college. His parents were professors at Michigan State. When he got married, I went up to the ceremony the morning of. I was running through Michigan State, and I came across this couple, and the young lady was laughing at me, and the guy just got beat red and looked like he wanted to punch me in the face. And I couldn't figure out why until I got back to the place where he'd stay overnight and realized I'd wore an Ohio State sweatshirt running through the Michigan State campus.
Oh, that's a no-no no matter where you go.
Oops.
That's terrible. Earl, damn it, that's terrible. Hey, Earl, thanks for being on the show. I appreciate it. People have been clamoring to get to know you better. I feel we accomplished that on a very minor level, as there's probably a lot more layers to you than we're able to hit in an hour. But I appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the invite.
Absolutely. And I just want to say to all the listeners going on right now, hope you're staying home. Hope you're staying safe. We're all in this together, waiting for baseball and life to get back to normal. And
yeah, let's see each other on the field somewhere.
Absolutely. And so semper fi to my son Ashton, and look forward to the next episodes coming out. We're coming to the end of season one. Just a couple seasons left, and then season two, we're gonna start all over again and do all kinds of stuff. So thanks for listening, everybody. Be safe.